Committee members, we're going to get started. I'm sorry, we're a little bit late here. Got four bills on the agenda today, and we have a problem apparently with our microphone recording system today, so they want us all to speak right into the phone, so into the, right, Martha, is that correct? Yeah, because we're doing the old-fashioned way of recording apparently today. So the first bill on today's agenda is Representative Isaacson.
Great.
Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. House File 2763, and it looks like that bill will be going to the General Register. So if you'd like to come forward and explain your bill. And
yeah, you have to. I have a speaker from House.
Okay. All right. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
That would be exciting to do that. Thank you. So moved.
Well, I think we better say the words. Will we move to re-refer House File 2763. Representative Isaacson moves to re-refer it to General Register. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, the governor has asked every agency to create an unsessioned bill, a laundry list of things we can do to make our agencies better. And that's what this is, and I have agreed to carry it, and I have Kate Twinko with me here, who I'm going to defer to her expertise as we walk us through the bill.
Great. Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm Katie Topinka from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
Welcome.
Thank you. And as Representative Isaacson said, this is Minnesota Housing's unsession bill. So it's part of the effort to repeal some obsolete statutes and just kind of clean up our statute a little bit. And we just have one unsession bill, and everything is in this bill that we're proposing. So I can go ahead and just walk through it and then take any questions. So the first article is the expiration of a reporting requirement. In 2000, the legislature authorized Minnesota Housing to develop a program that would provide rental housing that is affordable for families with incomes that qualify them for MFIP. It was called the Minnesota Families Affordable Rental Investment Fund. The agency received an appropriation for that in 2000, made loans under that program, but is no longer making any loans under that program, and there has not received a new appropriation to it. As part of it, we were required to, with DHS, report to the legislature on the status of the program. So with this first article here, we're just proposing that we put an expiration date on that report of 2020, which is 20 years after that initial appropriation, just because there aren't any new loans being made under the reports, so we thought it would make sense to make it expire at a certain point. Sure. And one other piece is there are no new appropriations coming for this program, and the agency is no longer making any new loans under the program, so there's no, there'll be no additional new information to put in that report.
Okay. Committee members, I'm wondering if we could just have her go through the bill and then take questions, or go right ahead. Go ahead. Representative Anderson.
Thanks for your indulgence, Madam Chair. The obvious question is, if this commission is really doing nothing, why wait till 2020 to sunset it?
Ms. Pinko.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. We are still tracking the incomes and outcomes that the families who did receive the loans together with DHS. We're tracking some of that information. So there are still some updates in that sense, but not new loans being made under the program. So we thought it might be appropriate to continue it for a few more years to just kind of see what the outcomes for those families are.
Said it. Okay. All right. Continue.
All right, thank you. Article 2 is another report that we're, this one we are proposing to eliminate. It's a local bond issue report. So when communities issue bonds for housing programs, right now they're required to hold a public hearing. They're required to submit their plan to either the Met Council or their local regional development commissions for review, and then MMB also publishes information on its website. In addition, currently in the statute, statute, cities are required to report to Minnesota Housing and the Met Council about the bond issue. There's also an additional legislative report. So we're proposing to eliminate those last two pieces. The communities are already going through public hearings. The information is readily available to the public. So we feel like it's just sort of duplicative to have that extra reporting requirement. So that is that section. And then Article 3 is a number of repealers to programs that have not been funded in more than 10 years and all have eligible uses under the agency's challenge program or housing trust fund program. So the first is the housing preservation program. This allowed the agency to make housing preservation grants to cities, and cities are able to apply to the agency through the challenge program for this the purposes outlined in this section, and this hasn't been funded since the mid-90s. The next is the Rent Assistance for Family Stabilization Program. This was last funded in 1999. It was a demonstration project through which Minnesota Housing and the Department of Human Services provided rental assistance to families receiving MFIP. The experiences from the program were incorporated into changes we made to the Housing Trust Fund program when it was expanded to include rental assistance. So we really used the lessons learned, incorporated to new program, and again, this isn't being funded anymore, so we think it's appropriate to take it out of our statute. The next is the Community Rehabilitation Fund account. Again, this is loans to cities, nonprofits, or for-profit organizations for construction or rehabilitation of housing. These are eligible uses under challenge, and it was last funded in 1999. And then finally, as far as the statutes, we have employer housing contributions. I think many of you will remember that this is part of the existing challenge program, that at least 50% of challenge funds must go to a project where there is a contribution from non-state resources. And we've tried really hard in recent years to get employer contributions as part of that and have done that successfully. And so we're just, because this is part of challenge, again, we're proposing that it be repealed. There are also a number of rules in this section that we're proposing to eliminate. Most of these haven't been funded since either the late 80s or early 90s. And then you'll also notice that the rental assistance for family stabilization is in there. So we're just proposing to repeal those as well to clean up our rule a little bit. And then just moving along, Article 4 is just some conforming changes. The bond issue report that I mentioned is mentioned in another part of the statute, so it's just eliminating that from that part of the statute as well. And then the last article is the state register notice. Minnesota Housing allocates federal low-income housing tax credits, and as part of that, we're required to publish information about the demographics of the state and a number of other things. And right now, we're required to publish that in the state register. And so we're proposing just to, rather than publishing all of it in the state register, publish in the state register where you can find it on our website. So it would just take down that publication from about, we're estimating 10, right now it's about 10 pages, it would take it down to about one. It would have a nominal savings to the agency, but it just seems like something that would make it more accessible to people and would be easier for people to find it that way. So that's it. I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like the idea of getting rid of this stuff, but I did have a question. You said that you're still monitoring, and you'll be monitoring the ongoing projects that are still there until 2020. Is that also the findings of that? Will that also be have to do with Article 5, where you don't have to publish those in the register?
Ms. Finka.
Madam Chair, Representative Green. No, those are separate. So the the report we were talking about expiring in 2020 is for that specific MARIF program that's no longer being funded. The state register notice pertains to the federal low-income housing tax credits, and there are some requirements in federal code related to the tax credits about information we have to publish and make available to people who might be seeking those tax credits. And so we still want to make sure that information is available. We're just proposing to post it on our website rather than in the state register, which is published by the Department of Administration every week. So we're just proposing to reduce the number of pages that are in there and let people know where they can find this information online.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just then on your website, and I know this is going to be sound really foolish, but what are the chances then of these things ever being deleted from the website? I mean, or you know, doing an update, or you know, so that this information is all of a sudden not available somewhere.
Mr. Mink. Madam Chair, Representative Green, Representative Isaacson, we were just discussing that we do, you know, information could be archived on the website but taken off of it. We do have a staff that updates our website regularly. Our communications team does that. We just did a big website overhaul last year and went through a process of taking down a lot of old information. And so that's certainly something we're regularly looking at. And this would be something that we would do every year when the notice of tax credits is available. So we would be looking at that closely because it would need to be updated each year.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I think we'd call this a good start. And thank you for coming up with what you did. I just checked with research, and the repealers would take effect August 1st. Was that correct?
Mr. Binka?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, I believe that's correct. We did not change any of the effective dates.
Okay. And especially in regard to Article 3, all those programs there, they're obsolete. Is there going to be a cost savings to your agency or anybody in the state government when these are gone?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, because these haven't been funded in a number of years, it really won't change the way we're administering programs. So I would say, you know, like I mentioned with the state register notice, there'd be a nominal cost savings. But with the rest of them, it's really more just cleaning up the statute and making it more clear to people who have to refer to it.
Just a question about, I think you mentioned some of these would able still to be found in the archives. Is that correct? Is that on the website, or how does one get to that?
Madam Chair, I was referring to specifically that state register notice that would be changed from year to year. I mean, information that's been on our website, we would be able to access it later. As far as the statutes themselves, I mean, they're certainly available in the, you know, legislative record over the years. So people would still be able to find them.
On the website?
I think on the registrar's website.
Registrar's website, okay. Okay. Any other questions? If not, Representative Isaacson, you want to renew your motion that House File 2763 be re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to the Register. Thank you. I think Representative Simon, I think you have a time conflict, so we're going to get you in next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And you'll have to speak into the microphone because our recording system is down and we're just having to do this the old-fashioned way with the recording.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. If someone could move the bill, I'd appreciate it.
I move.
Representative Isaacson moves that House File
859
be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Back in 2007 and 2008, I authored a bill that for the first time made explicit and in some detail the fact that victims of domestic violence could get out of their residential leases. And it's something that had broad bipartisan support. A lot of people worked on it, a lot of stakeholders. This is the sort of next generation of that bill, fine-tuning that bill that for the first time made that right and that privilege available. I'm going to turn it over to one or more testifiers to discuss kind of the status of the bill right now. There is vast agreement and only a little disagreement left between and among the stakeholders. And I want to thank the two testifiers you're going to hear from because they have really, since that bill in 2007 and 8, and since before that bill, worked in really good faith. And I'm particularly, I want to praise the work of the multi-housing folks and Mr. Lindquist and others back in 2007 and 2008 as well. They really did an extraordinary job then. And right now they're negotiating in good faith. So this bill has other committee stops. We aren't quite to total consensus yet, but we're very close, and I'll have the testifiers describe why that is.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Brian Elwood with Legal Aid, and I want to echo, well, first of all, I want to thank Representative Simon for carrying this bill this year again and updating what we did collectively several years ago, and I also want to echo his comments and praise for the Multi-Housing Association and Todd in particular, who have been just so constructive in listening to some of the concerns that we brought forward and working with us to address them, and I'm certainly hopeful and confident that we'll be able to get all the way to the goal line. Well, we're on the 5-yard line maybe at this point, so we're really close. Let me just quickly tell you what the bill does. An overview, it removes some of the barriers for tenants who are victims of violence and who live in these rental properties to break their lease if necessary. As Representative Simon mentioned, there is an existing right to do that, but over time we have found that some of the provisions that, or the prerequisites to do that, have created virtually insurmountable barriers for people to use what we decided was a really good idea collectively. So we're going to remove some of those barriers. The second thing the bill does is prohibit eviction of a tenant solely because he or she was a victim of violence. Third, it extends protections to victims who are not only victims of domestic violence, but also of sexual violence and stalking. And finally, it facilitates eviction for the perpetrators of that violence who are breaching the lease. So would it be useful simply to just to quickly walk through the sections?
That's fine.
So Section 1 amends the covenants. And what it simply does is add a covenant that you can't commit violence. That's simple. Seems a no-brainer, but what that actually does in practice is actually make it easier to get the perpetrators out if they're breaching the lease. I'm sorry. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, Representative Simon correctly pointed out we are working off the delete all, and
been amended. Representative Isaacson, do you want to
move the
delete all, which is labeled what? D?
D1.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? This puts it in the order that the author thought it was in. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and we're on the delete all amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, what I'm referring to now is the sections that are contained in the delete all, so I hope I didn't cause any confusion to anybody. Section 2 is the section that deals with the right to break the lease, and some of the changes there are as extending, as I mentioned, the coverage to victims of sexual assault and stalking. It allows documents that are produced by court officials, law enforcement officials, licensed healthcare professionals, domestic violence advocates, and sexual assault counselors, both of those terms, by the way, are defined elsewhere in statute, they would be qualifying documents to support the request to break the lease. It eliminates the requirement that the tenant pay liquidated damages equivalent to a month's rent, which has been the primary obstacle, and instead says the landlord just gets to keep the security deposit. So it sort of substitutes the security deposit as the liquidated damages for having somebody come up with additional money. It's basically the same thing. It's a month's rent, but it's just done in a different way that makes it easier for everybody. It addresses situations where tenants are the sole tenant, the victim is the sole tenant, and also in situations where the victim might be one of multiple tenants, because that's complicated. It creates a little more complication, and we've worked through that to make it easier for everybody. It adds some definitions. Section 3 talks about it's a conflict of law provision, because there's federal law, the Violence Against Women Act, which have similar provisions, and they apply to public housing. And so we just wanted to make sure that there was no ambiguity or conflict. And so Section 3 simply says that where federal law trumps, and so we just make sure that's clear. Mm-hmm. Section 4 deals with the eviction protection in the sense that it does prohibit a eviction solely based on the fact that a tenant was a victim of violence. And finally, Section 5 adds to the expedited eviction section of current law the ability to add eviction of a perpetrator under an expedited process. With that, I'm happy to ask Stanford questions, and I know Mr. Lindquist would like to say a few words.
Mr. Lindquist, do you want to weigh in on this first, and then we'll go to questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Todd Lindquist, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I have nothing additional to add, just like to thank the author and also like to thank Legal Aid for negotiating with us in good faith on this proposal. And we're still all moving in the same direction, and hopefully we can all reach the goal line together.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Elwood, you referred to Section 5 in the delete all amendment, but our delete all amendments only go through 6.5 Section 4. Is there a Section 5?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, I'm sorry, I should have said Section 3 is the section that deals with the expedited. I'm sorry. I think we're going to have to fix that one in civil law. My bad. I'm sorry. Apparently that was left out. I left that out of the delete also. It's not in this version. We'll fix that in the next committee. Sorry.
Has it hurt us?
So would you just restate again then what Section 5 is?
What should have been Section 5 would be to allow, in current law, there are a few circumstances where landlords can utilize something called an expedited eviction process, so get people out faster. And under current law, a perpetrator of violence, a tenant who is a perpetrator of violence, would not be covered under the expedited, so you'd have to go through there. It takes longer to get them out. And our agreement would be for everybody's best interest, the other tenants, everybody, that if that person is breaching the lease by committing violence, we want to get them out faster. And we would add that. It's my fault because I provided the language, and I obviously inadvertently omitted that section, and we will restore that back in civil law, and I apologize to the committee for that.
Mr. Elwood, I think it's in your original bill, right? Section 14 in the original bill. So that's where you can find the language.
I would just recommend that those units be located across the hall from the fire hose.
Okay. Any further? Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just one quick clarification question. This would also still, if there were more damage in the apartment, they would have to cover those costs, I'd assume, in part of their regular contract.
Madam Chair, Representative Metza, yes, the tenant would still be responsible for any damages to the unit. And any unpaid amounts owed.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be in this document somewhere, but it states that a tenant must sign and date advance written notice to the landlord. What would be an advance notice?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, that is actually in current law. So basically, if a situation arises where a tenant feels that she or he must flee, the requirement is two things. To provide a notice to the landlord saying, okay, I am leaving on this date. And then currently, they would have to supply a no-contact order or a copy of a no-contact order or an order for protection. And we're going to add a couple of more documents that would be able to support the request to leave. It's already in current law. It's been operating that way for, 7 years now?
Representative Moran?
Madam Chair, but I'm thinking about the purpose of the reason of bringing this forward. I'm in a domestic abuse, and I'm fleeing, you know, so I cannot return to the property because I'm scared, right? But I need to give notice to my landlord in advance. And so I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to get a clear picture of what that would look like. You know, and because I wouldn't be no longer in occupying.
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, I think what advance notice doesn't necessarily mean I can't leave the unit before I give notice. It means I can't break my lease before I give notice. So I can physically leave the unit and then provide the notice, which is typically what happens in every case. Mm-hmm. So if I'm hearing you right, mm-hmm, or understanding you right, I think the concern that I'm hearing from you is that we wouldn't want a victim to have to remain in the premises in an unsafe,
right,
condition before giving notice. Well, that is not the case now. It wouldn't be the case after this bill would pass. Mm-hmm. Is that clarify the concern?
Yeah. Representative Moran?
My name's here. That brings some clarity, but I guess they would still be beholden to that lease or that payment until the landlord is given notification.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Moran, it actually is a protection for both parties, because that by providing that notice, that actually releases the tenant from any legal obligation for the remainder of the rent. So it's actually a tenant protection section, you know, provision, as well as then providing the balance, because the landlords were expecting that rent for the remainder of the lease, and they're not going to get it. So then they were able then to know that they are able to take that security deposit and use that as the essentially the liquidated damages. So it's kind of a way to balance the interests of everybody and while protecting the safety of the tenant.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, Representative Isaacson, you want to renew your motion that House Bill 859,
yes,
as amended,
yes,
be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way to civil law. Thank you.
Thank you, members and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Simon. I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Radinovich.
Representative Clark, would you
Thank
like to
you.
Move your bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2246 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Perfect.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm bringing before you a bill that just, it doesn't cost anything more than it did when we passed it last year, but we need to place it in a different place in the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and we're going to hear the reasons why it wasn't quite working out to be able to be utilized the way it was intended, and so we're going to be moving it over to be a direct appropriation, a grant through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, rather than having to kind of struggle with some of the problems that they were having being inside another program, the Minnesota Housing Trust Fund. So I'm going to let Mr. Thomas explain. This is a fabulous program that I think maybe some of you remember the testimony we had. This is for high-risk adults who come out of prison and who are able to enter into a program. This really makes all the difference in the world. I'm going to let Mr. Thomas brag about that and also tell us the need, the reason why we need this to bill to pass today.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Clark. Members of the committee, my name is Steve Thomas. I'm the president and CEO of Better Futures Minnesota. Just a brief update. We intentionally embrace high-risk men who are leaving jail or prison. They're homeless upon release. They have histories of chemical addiction, mental illness, and a very poor employment history. We've designed a housing model that provides immediate access to safe, decent housing for these men. I can say for the last 20 years, and my colleague Tim Marks back there, we've built a lot of affordable housing in this community, and most of the men we serve can't get in, either because of their criminal backgrounds, their rent history. Those are the two main reasons. So the model we've developed, and that the MHFA has been incredibly helpful in helping us create, is first, everyone arrives at our guest house. It's a communal dorm living kind of situation where you're expected to demonstrate that you can earn the right to be a good tenant. That means you have a job, you pay your rent, you keep a clean apartment. From there, we move people on to apartments which are hard to come by, where we provide a time-limited fixed rent subsidy. And over that time, they have to earn enough, keep working, earn enough money to assume full responsibility for the rent once our short-term subsidy ends. The challenge with the current appropriation, and again, I want to emphasize the department's been very helpful in trying to make this work within the Housing Trust Fund, is that it restricted the amount of funding that could go to our guest house, which is in many ways our most important first stop. And two, it restricts the amount, it restricts our ability to use the rent subsidy program that we've been testing and refining. So this change in language would basically mirror the language that the grant had in 2009, 2011, when we worked with the department to build this model.
Thank you. Any questions? No?
If not,
seeing none, are there any final comments the author would like to make?
Just, I appreciate the committee's support of the bill, and it is a program that really works, and we'll take it on to Ways and Means. So I guess I would renew my motion, Mr. Chairman, that House File 2246 be referred to Ways and Means Committee.
The chair has renewed her motion to re-refer House File 2246 to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ready, thank you, Mr. Radinovich. Good job. I believe that next House File 2493 is before us, and this is Representative Mariani's bill, but Representative Moran, you're also a co-author, and I believe you're going to pinch hit today. I know you'll do a good job. Welcome back to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a co-author of House File 2493, I would like to move it.
Okay, Representative Moran moves that House File 2493 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, an estimated 14,000 Minnesotans are homeless on any given day. And the number of homeless Minnesotans increased over 30% since 2006. That includes children and youth under 31 who make up half of the homeless population. So what this bill would do is that this bill would appropriate, I guess before I go ahead, there's an author amendment I need to make.
Oh, okay. Let's see. I don't have that in front of me. Let me just pull it up here.
In section 2 of the bill, we're asking for appropriation of $22 million. I would like to amend that to $18
Well, I guess we don't have, this is an oral amendment?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so would you just say what those words are again? If it's a couple of words, maybe the committee will indulge that. Let us just hear what the words
okay.
are.
Okay. In section 2, line 1.19, we'd like to amend the $22 million to $18 million.
You're reducing it to what?
18.
Is there any objection to of any of the folks for this oral amendment? It would be reducing $22 million to $18 million. No objections? Okay. We will allow you to
Madam
have
Chair.
An amendment. All in favor? Oh, excuse me. Is there a question?
Does she also want to amend page 2, line 6?
Yes.
And page 2, line 2.6 as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any objection? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Carry on.
So,
Madam Chair,
this bill would appropriate $18 million in general obligation bonds to design, construct, furnish, and equip a publicly owned building or portion of a building to provide emergency shelter located next to a housing facility in a public-owned building to be used to provide connection services that prevents homelessness. And this building itself will be located in St. Paul. And I would like to refer any to explain the bill in more detail to Tim Marks.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Representative Moran, thank you. My name is Tim Marks. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Charities of Greater Minneapolis-St. Paul, and here to speak to the Dorothy Day revision. What I would like to do is tell you a little bit about the Dorothy Day Center, what it has become, speak to you the urgent need for a revision. Second, talk to you about the proposal that is before you and the community to revision the Dorothy Day Center. And third, talk about the financing. And when I talk about the proposal, I'll also talk about the siting issues that you may have heard about. Many of you have heard about, seen, and some have volunteered at the Dorothy Day Center in downtown St. Paul, right in the shadow of this Capitol and the commercial gateway to the city of St. Paul, our capital city. The Dorothy Day Center was built in 1981 and was intended to be a drop-in center, a place to get services so that people could move on. It was never intended to be a shelter that people would sleep at. And as homelessness increased over the course of these many years, the Dorothy Day Center was asked to do more and more. First, can you shelter in a portion of the center just at the winter nights? While it is cold. Second, can you open up the entire facility to a shelter? And can you do it year-round? Then can you find a place for women who are increasingly homeless? Then can, for those, because we're short of detox space, can you provide a non-medical detox? And so over these 30 years now, Dorothy Day has been asked to do more and more with less and less, and we have now reached the urgent crisis point at the Dorothy Day Center, where it's an increasingly dangerous, where up to 250 people each night sleep apart on thin mats, taking their evening meals there. And increasingly, it's a place where people get stuck. And we are finding it increasingly difficult that when people show up to find a preventive solution to their homelessness or to provide them a pathway out of poverty. The Dorothy Day Center provides 85% of the drop-in services for single adults in Ramsey County, in 80% of the shelter beds in Ramsey County, and it is at the breaking point, so this is an urgent situation. Because of that urgent situation, and in 2011, we actually had to start turning people away from the Dorothy Day Center, Mayor Coleman established a task force last May to ask the community to come together on a new solution for Dorothy Day, leading to new solutions to homelessness throughout the community and in coordination with the efforts of the state of Minnesota, as the state of Minnesota was moving forward with its new plan, which is now released. That task force was co-chaired by Matt Kramer, who is the president of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, and Carlene Rhodes, the president of the St. Paul Foundation, and many other cross-sectoral members from throughout the community came together to forward a recommendation to the mayor, which the mayor accepted. And that recommendation has three kind of critical components. We've all come to learn that the best solution to homelessness is more housing. So the bedrock solution to the Dorothy Day Center is 135 units of new housing. And that is why we are so supportive of and urge your continued support of the Homes for All proposal for $100 million to meet critical housing needs throughout the state. That is a critical element of the Dorothy Day revision and in meeting housing needs throughout the state. So more housing. Second, unfortunately, we have now discovered that shelter is going to be a part of our housing continuum for a while. It looked like as we were coming, before the Great Recession, we might be able not to have to rely on shelter at all and phase it out. Unfortunately, because of the Great Recession, we are going to need shelter, but shelter should be dignified and shelter should be linked to permanent solutions. So another portion of the Dorothy Day revision is dignified shelter that will, when people show up, they don't have to stay there long because they're treated with dignity and it's linked to permanent solutions. And this is based upon a model financed in large part by the state through the same type of bonds that we're asking through for Homes for All, the higher ground model in Minneapolis, which opened now almost 2 years ago, which is housing people who were homeless for the longest periods of time. It is taking those who have been on the streets for the longest period of time. It is reducing shelter stays, and it is moving people into permanent housing with dignity. So permanent housing, dignified shelter. The third component of the proposal is a connection or opportunity center so that there is a place for those who are experiencing homelessness to be at during the day, where they can get access to meals, to health care, to employment services, to their benefits, to ID cards, all of those various connective services that when somebody shows up before they need shelter, we try to divert them to another solution. Or second, when they have to be in shelter, we find a permanent solution. All of these solutions, all of these type of interventions avoid significant other public crisis dollars, such as health care costs, emergency rooms, detox, and other types of things. So housing, dignified shelter, opportunity center are the three main components of the Dorothy Day revision proposal. As you may know, there has been a degree of controversy over the proposed location of the higher ground in St. Paul and the opportunity or connection center. We are working to resolve those issues and expect to announce a new solution very soon that we think will have community consensus, that we'll be able to go forward with on a timely basis. And we're getting the support of St. Paul stakeholders around a different site that we think will reach consensus. So that's something that we can talk more later about in detail once that's more finalized. Now, the financing of this Dorothy Day revision, you see in your packet this kind of one-page sheet that talks about the financing plan. What we are talking about in terms of this legislation is the higher ground shelter, which you see at $12 million, and the connection center that you see at $10 million. The a portion above that, the $17 million for the higher ground housing, that will compete through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency process for those housing infrastructure bonds that you will hopefully appropriate through this process. The shelter and the connection center, since those are not housing, there is no ready avenue for state resources. That's why the city of St. Paul, with Ramsey County support, has put in an application for GO bonding. So these projects would be owned by the city of St. Paul or another public entity. And we needed that mechanism because it is not housing. So that's the $22 million that was in the original legislation. We are trying to build a public-private partnership to advance this revision. That's why Representative Moran reduced the ask, the proposed appropriation, to $18 million. We have a generous foundation, local foundation, that has agreed to provide a $5 million challenge grant to support the revision that hope will be a springboard for other efforts to establish a public-private partnership. And so we think that is a good signal that if the public invests, the private sector will follow, and we can build that type of partnership. And we do not want to leave that challenge grant on the table from that generous foundation donor. So with that, Madam Chair, members, we'll stand for any kind of questions you have, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was when you're looking through this, and it says in the bill that the facility has to be located next to a housing project, and there's no funds available for the housing project. It looks like you're relying on the fact that there might be bonding money available. You don't know yet. How is that going to conflict to pass this bill before you know if there's going to be housing located next to it?
Mr. Marks.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, so if you look at this sheet again, you see the $17 million for higher ground, 12 and 10 for the shelter and the connection center. That was similar to the way higher ground was built 2 years ago, where Catholic Charities applied for housing infrastructure bonds to finance the facility, and then we developed the other funding in order to build the shelter component. And so what we would do is compete for the housing funds, and I expect through the process, the way it works with the housing finance agency, that these funds would be kind of coordinated so that one wouldn't be appropriated or released finally from the sources until it was sure that there was a full package that kind of came together. And it's because two different sources are required here that we have to go this route, but through the administrative process, they'd be coordinated so that they are going to build one building.
Representative Green.
Thank you. The existing shelter, is what will become of that? Is there any chance to remodel that, or is it just going to be sold or destroyed?
Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's not totally clear yet. Depending upon how these siting issues work out, it is possible that a portion of the current Dorothy Day Center will be subject to kind of partial rehabilitation, but we have the challenge of continuing to serve people as we're rehabilitating, and we're trying to work out the logistics so that if we are able to construct a higher ground near where the current Dorothy Day Center is, which is the direction I think we are headed, we would then try to reconstruct the Dorothy Day Center, at least a portion of it, while we're continuing to provide services on that current site, which would make that site available either for redevelopment or for additional use for the Catholic Charities mission.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. The summary that we have here says the bond proceeds would be used for a publicly owned building or a portion of a building. Explain how we would fund part of a building, possibly.
Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair, Representative, the way that the bonding process works, as you know, if it's general obligation bonds, that it has to be a publicly owned building. And there's a model that many of us have been a part of where we then lease from the public entity under terms and conditions. It is also happens on occasion, and there's buildings and developments like this throughout the state, including at Catholic Charities, where a portion of the building is financed with GO bonds, and a portion of the building is financed with housing infrastructure bonds or other sources. But we work together to make sure that one hand knows what the other is doing, and it's a complete package. And it takes a little bit of legal work and financial mechanisms to make it happen. But it's really an effort to facilitate the type of public-private partnership where Catholic Charities and our donors might provide a part of the building for part of the programming. And then we work with our public partner to see what's going to be financed by the public, but we make sure there's good agreements between the two so that we can operate a sound program and the building is maintained. And there's numerous examples of this. The Center for Changing Lives, Lutheran Social Service, for example, on Park Avenue in Minneapolis, and many others.
Any further questions, comments? Okay, anybody from the audience who wants to testify? Okay, if not, the bill is before us. Representative Moran, you want to renew your motion that House File 2493 be re-referred to capital investment? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Unanimously off to capital investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Committee members, it looks like we're going to get out early today unless there's any other business. I guess not. And we went through four bills, so I congratulate you on your efficiency. And we have the minutes before us, and Representative Hertas has been reading them, I can tell.
And Madam Chair, I'll move that we approve the minutes.
Okay, the minutes of March 5th are before us. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion are approved and adopted. Thank you, committee members, and we meet next Wednesday, and I know we have a busy agenda then, too. Thank you, committee members. The meeting is adjourned.